We are pleased to have Professor Freddie Woods as our devotional speaker this morning. Brother Woods served a full-time mission to Adelaide, Australia, following his baptism into the church when he was age 20. He completed a Bachelor of Science degree in Psychology and a Master of Science degree in International Relations, both at Brigham Young University. He earned his Ph.D. from the University of Utah in Middle East Studies with an emphasis in Hebrew Bible. Dr. Woods has been a professor in BYU's Department of Church History and Doctrine for the past decade and has been a Richard L. Evans Professor of Religious Understanding for the last 3 years. In this assignment, he has lectured at numerous universities in the United States and internationally. His primary area of research is Mormon immigration to America in the 19th century. He is the editor and compiler of the Mormon Immigration Index, CD, which was released by the church in 2000 and is now being used worldwide at LDS Church Family History Centers. Brother Woods is married to the former Joanne Merrill. They have 5 children and 2 granddaughters. And now we'll have the opportunity of hearing from Brother Fred Woods.
Thank you, President Samuelson. Brothers and sisters, aloha. Before we get started, I thought I needed to explain this red tie, because when I got up this morning, my 16-year-old son Freddie said, "Hey, Dad, why are you wearing that tie to the devotional?" He's an avid BYU Cougar fan. I pointed out that on the very bottom we have BYU Hawaii. So aloha to you. I express gratitude to the BYU administration for this opportunity to address you this morning. My remarks are dedicated to my mother, who taught me that every human being is a child of God, and that he loves all his children, and we should love them as well, regardless of race or religion. Although my parents are not LDS, they have been a great support to me throughout my life. In December of 2003, I went to Hawaii to do research and invited my wife Joanna to go with me because I knew we would have a few days at the end of my work week to also celebrate our 24th wedding anniversary. My research focused on the LDS history of La'ie on the island of Oahu. But I asked Joanna where she would like me to go, where she would like to go on the Hawaiian Islands for our anniversary celebration. She replied that her priority would be to visit the Kalapapa leprosy settlement on the north shore of the island of Molokai. We'd been reading about this unique place, and I thought her suggestion was perfect. Our trip included a precarious mule ride down the steep 2,000-foot cliffs of the Molokai Range, which eventually spilled out into a 4-mile peninsula of sacred space, a transforming terra firma known as Kalapapa. The literal translation of Kalapapa may be rendered flat plain or flat leaf. In either case, it is surely a leveling experience for all who cross the boundaries of their own professed beliefs and ethnicity into a larger realm of brotherhood and compassion. For it is here that religious denominations and cultural divides dissolve, where the love of God and mankind manifest themselves in a magnificent way. This smooth, beautiful peninsula seems most appropriate to symbolize the universal love of a supreme being who encompasses all 4 corners of the earth. Structures erected in this region for more than a century include places of worship for Protestants, Catholics, and Latter-day Saints, as well as a small Buddhist temple. It is a place that not only includes a variety of Christian strains, but also extends beyond this realm, embracing an array of other views. In a world made up of thousands of religious verities, the unconditional love and spirit of acceptance that exist on Kalapapa truly stand as an example to all of us. After passing through some of the most beautiful landscape our eyes had ever beheld, we met LDS church member Kule Bell at the Kalapapa post office. At that time, Kule was employed as the Kalapapa postal clerk. We had a wonderful visit, and it was then that I determined to write a history of the Latter-day Saints in this region. Nearly 5 years have come and gone since that time, and I'm still researching and writing that history. However, after my first visit, I decided that a larger story of Kalapapa must also be told. The story of the valiant patients and volunteers who worked together and inspired each other despite their differing faiths. Joanna and I went away from our first encounter with this small settlement feeling much the way that Elder Matthew Cowley felt when he encountered Kalapapa in the mid-20th century. Quote, I went there apprehended that I would be depressed. I left knowing that I'd been exalted. I had expected that my heart, which is not too strong, would be torn with sympathy, but I went away feeling that it had been healed. He added, I went appreciating my friends, loving my enemies, worshiping God, and with a heart purged of all pettiness. This is a transformation for me, and for it, I am indebted to the saints of Kalapapa. As 1865 dawned, the Hawaiian government's concern over the disease had escalated to the point that King Kamehameha V signed a document intent on preventing the spread of this malicious malady. The writ designated a self-contained region surrounded by natural borders for victims on the eastern portion of the Kalapapa Peninsula, a place called Kalawao. The following year, the first patients began arriving. Millions of people worldwide are still infected with this disease, which affects primarily the skin and nerves. However, less than 5% of our human population is susceptible to its devastation. In 1873, a Norwegian physician named Dr. Gerhard Hansen discovered the cause of this sickness, a bacillus, lepre, and as a result, the illness began to be referred to as Hansen's disease. In 1981, this name was officially adopted in Hawaii as the medical term for leprosy, which usage patients prefer, since the former term possesses a negative stigma in biblical literature, which intimates that its victims were unclean. Between 1866 and 1969, over 8,000 people were forcibly removed to the Kalapapa Peninsula. By 1969, drugs were developed which arrested the disease, and patients were again free to move abroad as they wished. In 1980, Kalapapa was named a national park. Today, about 24 patients still live in the settlement or in Honolulu at the Hale Mahalo Hospital, and with their passing, the park will eventually extend its influence throughout the entire region. In the same year that Dr. Hansen made his medical discovery, two ecclesiastical leaders from different faiths first made their appearance on the Kalapapa Peninsula. One was a Latter-day Saint named Jonathan Hawaii Napella, the other a Belgian priest, Father Damien Joseph de Veuster, who will be canonized by the Roman Catholic Church in the coming year. Napella was born on the island of Maui in 1813, became a district judge in 1848, and converted to Mormonism in 1852. He was a tremendous aid to early LDS missionary work on the Hawaiian Islands, as he fed and housed the elders, helped them learn his native language, and aided Elder George Q. Cannon with the translation of the Book of Mormon. Though Cannon taught Napella the restored gospel, Jonathan Napella on several occasions taught Cannon and the Utah elders a greater dimension of faith. Perhaps his greatest contribution to humankind is his example as a loving husband. When his wife Kitty contracted the disease, Jonathan chose to remain with her in the settlement and act as her kokua, a Hawaiian word meaning helper. Consequently, Jonathan wrote a letter in his native language, Hawaiian, to the Board of Health, pleading that he might be allowed to stay with his wife. He wrote, On August 3, 1843, I took my wife as my legally married wife, and on that same day I vowed before God to care for my wife in health and sickness and until death do us part. I am 60 years old and I do not have much longer to live. During the brief time remaining, I want to be with my wife. My wife has also lived a long life, but with this disease, it will quickly shorten her life. Such is the reason for this petition. Luckily, Jonathan's request was granted, and he spent the remaining years of his life at Kalapapa with Kitty. While here, Napella encountered yet another way to serve those around him. Not long after his arrival, he was called to act as the leader of the LDS Church on the Kalapapa Peninsula, a calling he held from 1873 until his death in 1879 from the effects of Hansen's disease. Perhaps not coincidentally, Father Damien arrived at Kalapapa in the same year that Napella's did. This Belgian priest would eventually gain international fame because of his demonstration of faith and attitude of selfless service on the island, best captured by his own words. Suppose the disease does get my body. God will give me another one on Resurrection Day. From the day of his arrival in 1873 until his death at age 49, his concern for all the patients, regardless of race or religion. However, the core of his heart seemed to belong to the orphan children, whom he often loved in singing. His Christian service on the Kalapapa Peninsula serves as an important reminder of Elder Orphan F. Whitney's words offered in a 1921 General Conference address. God has been using not merely his covenant people, but other peoples of the world as well, to carry out a work that is too demanding for the limited numbers of Latter-day Saints to accomplish by themselves. Other good and great men and women have been inspired of God under many circumstances to deliver dimensions of light and truth. Soon after their arrival at the settlement, Jonathan Nepel and Father Damien became acquainted. Both had come to Kalapapa to serve, and both contracted Hansen's disease as a result of their charity. Damien was 27 years younger than Napella, and the cultural background of each was very different. Yet both were firmly committed to their religious orientations. Though ecclesiastical leaders of different faiths, they became dear friends. In fact, one of their contemporaries who lived at Kalapapa wrote, "After Father Damien arrived in the leper settlement, Mr. J. Nepela and Father Damien were the best of friends." What makes this relationship particularly unusual is the fact that at this time, heated rivalries existed between faiths as they vied for island converts. Yet at Kalapapa, there seems to have developed a different kind of spiritual terrain, nourished by the relationship between these two great men and their commitment to improve the decadent moral conditions upon their encountered upon their arrival at the settlement. Reporting to the Board of Health on the depraved situation of the patients, Damien wrote, "They numbered 816. Some of them were old acquaintances of mine from Hawaii, where I was previously stationed. To the majority, I was a stranger. They were all living at Kalawao. They passed their times with playing cards, hula, drinking, alcohol. Their clothes in general were far from being clean and decent. The miserable condition of the settlement at that time gave it the name of a living graveyard." Damien further noted, "Many an unfortunate woman had to become a prostitute to obtain friends who would take care of her and children when well and strong were used as servants." Such conditions created a need for these men to unite hands with those patients who desired to improve their spiritual environment. Through the influence of Damien, Nepela, and a number of other Avon Christian, Reformation soon made headway. Over the years, Kalapapa softened under the strain of the suffering that transpired there. One former patient named Bernard noted that Kalapapa used to be viewed as a devil's island, a gateway to hell, worse than a prison. Yet he added, "Today it is a gateway to heaven. There is a spirituality to the place. All the suffering of those blood who has touched the land, the effect is so powerful, even the rain cannot wash it away." Another patient and friend named Makia Malo noted, "They thought it was hell, and we thought it was heaven." In interviews, some patients have related how their spirituality has been affected by their Kalapapa experience, especially as it pertains to prayer. For example, one patient named Nancy Tolino stated, "We were nurtured not just by a Protestant or a Mormon or even Catholic nuns. Everyone worked together. Everyone needed prayers. There were prayers. And I was thankful that I was very close to God. Someone asked, 'Do you ask God why?' I said, 'No, I don't. I just say, maybe it's a wake-up call. I thank him. I want people to know, to really know the love in the hearts of the people of Kalapapa. We've got hearts. We've got hearts." Another patient who came to Kalapapa at age 14 in 1936 also shared her experience of prayer and the importance of expressing gratitude to God, even in times of adversity. She said, God knows best for us. You must keep your faith no matter what comes into your life. You must still be able to thank the Lord for the many other blessings that we receive and keep this faith all the time, no matter what comes into our life. Because I feel religion is not thanking God when everything is good. Religion is thanking God when everything isn't going right. This vertical relationship with the heavens seems to have also affected the horizontal relationships among the patients themselves. Furthermore, several people who have had contact with the Kalapapa patients have spoken of the unifying effects which appear to be inherent in the suffering of this disease. For example, in his book Travels to Hawaii, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote of his visit to Kalapapa explaining, "They were strangers to each other, collected by common calamity." Protestant writer Ethel Damon noted, "Surely the isolation of suffering has tended towards obliterating the barriers in religious observance." Reverend James Drew further observed, "They are brothers and sisters here. Leprosy has made sure of that." One Asian patient named Paul Harada echoed the same theme. "The more we suffer, the more strength we have. The more suffering, the closer we are together. Life is that way. If you haven't suffered, then you don't know what joy is. The others may know something about joy, but those who have gone through hell and high water, I think they feel the joy deeper." And referring to the Kalapapa community, the same patient told me, "We are all friends. There is an ecumenical philosophy here." In a number of interviews conducted over the past several years, I have certainly seen and heard indications of the ecumenical attitude at Kalapapa. For example, Latter-day Saint patient Kule Bell related at times she was recruited to sing in the Catholic choir. Not only is Kule sung with the Catholic choir, but she and her dear friend and fellow patient Lucy Keono, also a Latter-day Saint, have made other trips to Father Damien's church in Kalawao at St. Filomeno, 3 miles from Kalapapa, to enjoy the chapel's acoustics and especially to sing to Father Damien as a tribute to his charitable service. Another example of ecumenism was relayed in a humorous way by Richard Marks, a former patient, a Catholic, and the sheriff of Kalapapa for nearly 2 decades with a record of no arrests. In describing the Catholic Mass in Kalapapa at Christmas time, Marks explained, "The Protestants and Mormons came early and they took the back seats, so we had to sit up front." Another Catholic patient, affectionately known by his friends as Boogie, noted, "We know all about the things we went through. I think that's one reason we feel like a family. When we had a function going on, the whole community just comes together." Apparently, this kind of attitude prevailed throughout the 20th century. Latter-day Saint convert Mary Singh recalled, "When I came to Kalapapa in 1917, everybody was just living like a family. Nobody says anything bad about the other religion. Everybody was together. See, they respected, you know, each church." Mary added, "If the Catholics had a party, they waited for the Mormon people to get through with their service. And so it is with the Protestant. Everybody was happy." One patient, Edwin Lillipalli, known affectionately as Polly, had a very active member of the Protestant community, recalled, quote, "Us in the Catholic Church and the Mormon Church, we're always getting together. When it was something big, we always joined together and enjoy it," end of quote. One memorable ecumenical service occurred soon after the Lions Club erected a cross at the crater on Kalapapa, shortly before the Easter celebration of 1948. Excuse me. Easter celebration of 1948. One author wrote of the assemblage of different Christian faiths. "The two Mormon elders assisted Pastor Alice in the service. Many Roman Catholics were present. The people sang as never before their joyous message, carrying on the wind, even to the sufferers in the hospital at Kalapapa." Perhaps the most impressive piece of Kalapapa's interfaith collaborative work is the construction of various places of worship. For example, Polly expressed his joy and gratitude when members of the settlement joined in 1966 to help restore the Protestant Siloama Chapel. Polly said, "We had the Protestants, we had the Catholics, we had the Mormons all chip in to build this church. They wanted to help this church. When you came here, you could just feel the spirit of love. It was special working with them. It was just beautiful. I can never thank them enough. It was wonderful. When asked if the same was true when a 20th century Catholic church was erected, he added that everyone joined in to help us raise some funds for the church. Everybody would help out, and that's how it was in Kalapapa. That's what's so different about Kalapapa, Polly said. When somebody needs help, everybody's there. Finally, this patient explained, "This is our family. I don't care what religion. That's how we felt. When they are in need of help, we're there. You see, we always go. We don't have to be asked. That's how we were brought up here in Kalapapa. Somehow that great love for everybody just brought us together." The same spirit of love and collaboration that existed during the construction of the Catholic and Protestant churches was also evident in 1965 when a new Latter-day Saint chapel was built to replace the older 1904 chapel, which had deteriorated. When the building was dedicated at the close of the year and the worked hours tallied, it was discovered that those of other faiths had actually donated more hours in its construction than the Latter-day Saints had. All worked hard, and some of those with disabilities had their hands wired to the wheelbarrows that they might do their share. The entire settlement joined in celebration over the knowledge that their LDS friends had a new chapel to worship in. In early 2005, I learned that both BYU Hawaii and Chaminade, a Catholic university in Honolulu, were celebrating their Jubilee anniversaries. I approached the presidents of both schools at BYU Hawaii, President Shumway, and Chaminade President Sue Wesselkamper, about the idea of a joint celebration on each campus, and explained that it seemed natural to share this wonderful interfaith story, which seemed to have commenced with the friendship between Damien and Apella. They listened attentively and agreed to it. One important factor, which no doubt aided in the acceptance of the proposal, was when I met with President Sue and another Chaminade administrator who asked if we could begin our meeting by reading some of the comforting words which had been recently spoken by President Hinckley at the April 2005 General Conference regarding the passage of Pope John Paul II. On this occasion, President Hinckley said, and I read to them, I extend to our Catholic neighbors and friends our heartfelt sympathy at this time of great sorrow. Pope John Paul II has worked tirelessly to advance the cause of Christianity, to lift the burdens of the poor, and to speak fearlessly in behalf of moral values and human dignity. He will be greatly missed, particularly by the very many who have looked to him for leadership. I believe these inspired words helped strengthen a friendship with Chaminade and open the way for the proposal which came to fruition during the fall of 2005. During this period, I presented the Kalapapa story of interfaith collaboration to students and faculty on both campuses as part of the Jubilee celebrations. In addition, over the past 3 years as an Evans Professor of Religious Understanding, I've had the opportunity to share this edifying story at several conferences and with numerous students attending many universities. This story has also encouraged a brotherhood with leaders of different faiths. However, the most tender part of my experience has been getting to know the Kalapapa community and to feel the spirit of the patients who are now my friends. A 60-minute documentary directed by Ethan Vincent titled The Soul of Kalapapa will be released next year to tell their story and will be shown at the World Parliament of Religions to be held in Melbourne, Australia in December 2009. I now like to just show a short trailer of this documentary before I conclude.
It's thought that somewhere between 8,000 and 9,000 people were sent to the settlement and are laid to rest there. And so it is overwhelming at times to see the amount of death that surrounds you even today and the number of cemeteries and headstones that are there. And then to contrast that with the incredible beauty of the place, it's one of those paradoxes that it's very difficult to come to terms with.
There used to be a priest that would come to serve part-time from England when the regular priest was on vacation. He told me that the two holiest places in the world, as far as he was concerned, was Jerusalem and Kalapapa.
You know, for many of them, when they came here, they saw this place as a prison. You know, it's basically surrounded by water on three sides and a cliff 2,000 feet high on the other side. But now in their old age, a lot of them many of them, I would say, see this place more as a place of refuge, away from the rest of the world. And they're very happy and content here now.
I think people should know about Kalapa. I think people should know about the patients and how they live. And I think people should know about administration and National Park. I think they should know. Because Kalapapa is ours, I would say that. It's the people. The people makes Kalapapa. And if that's the patients, they want to make Kalapapa.
Everybody was united in a family of suffering, but everybody was united in a family of overcoming. Faulkner talks about, you know, man must not survive, man must prevail, man must overcome, man must succeed over his environment and over those things that hold him back.
It is a very peaceful place. The mana, the essence of this place, is positive. It's not negative. So we come here and we feel rejuvenated.
We first begun.
The charity and uncommon service rendered at Kalapapa serves as a reminder of the importance of erecting bridges instead of barriers, finding common ground instead of battleground, and in valuing one another regardless of ethnicity and religiosity. To me, it provides a vivid illustration for the need of Latter-day Saints to not only join hands, but to look outside the circle of our faith community and to take Elder M. Russell's charge seriously. To love one another, be kind to one another despite our deepest differences. Such an ecumenical philosophy of inclusiveness seems to be desperately needed in a world that suffers from societal diseases such as selfishness, pride, bigotry, and prejudice. In addition, it is hoped that the short treatise on the Kalapapa settlement will serve as a reminder of the acute need for each of us to generate light instead of heat, and to apply the maxim of St. Augustine, in the essentials, unity, in non-essentials, liberty, and in all things, charity. I testify that I know that God lives and he loves all of his children. I testify that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.